From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, looking at damage from storms and potential flooding across Michigan.
It's never been to this height. Last year was the highest recorded heights we had for the river system up here. We are 0.7 feet over last year's high.
Then one Northern Michigan writer talks about the harms of social media to our attention spans.
They're completely constructed and built to give us these sensations that feel really good and sparkly for like 3 seconds.
And it's a campaign trail roundup with the team from It's Just Politics.
The only people who can really compete with the PACs and with the money that's coming from the PACs are going to be people who already either are wealthy or who have wealthy contacts.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This hour, the team from It's Just Politics brings us a roundup on the latest from the campaign trail in Michigan. But first, let's talk about this weather. Washtenaw County in southeast Michigan was probably the hardest hit with the storm that swept across the state last night. Several large trees are down on the city's west side. Roads may be impassable. Perhaps the most shocking damage was to a couple of ice arenas. University of Michigan's Yost Ice Arena lost some large pieces of roofing. Veterans Memorial Park Arena lost a whole side of its building to high winds. Let's listen to a little of a report from WDIV in Detroit earlier this morning.
You can see that the wall basically just got ripped apart, and whatever's left over just fell over to the side of this plot here. We've got some water from the rain, obviously, pooling up just right beside it. We do have a crew nearby getting ready to do whatever they have to do to make sure that they can get started on the work ahead for them. But I can tell you right now, something really powerful ripped through here, because on Jackson Avenue, which is where the Veterans Memorial Park is off of, we see multiple trees are down on people's properties and in the streets, of course.
Other southeast communities like Inkster also took damage. While the wind has been distressing, the story of these storms and the wet weather this week is really most affecting Michiganders up north. Dams across the northern band of the state are at risk of failing as snow melts, the ground thaws, and rain pours down. We've invited a couple of reporters from our sister stations in mid and northern Michigan to talk to us about what they're seeing. Claire Keenan-Kurgan is a reporter with Interlochen Public Radio just outside of Traverse City. She was in several different regional areas yesterday. Claire, hi.
Hi, April. Good to be here.
Also with us is AJ Jones, a reporter with WCMU in Mount Pleasant. AJ, welcome back.
Happy to be here, April. Thank you.
Claire, let's start out with you. What water? I know you were spending some time in Bel Air yesterday. What waterways in Bel Air are at risk right now?
Yeah, so waterways across northern Michigan are at really high levels right now. I had some trouble getting to work because the road that I usually take in, there's a bridge that was just totally washed out. And that's here near Traverse City. But I drove to Bel Air yesterday, and Bel Air is on a river called the Intermediate River. And there is a dam in Bel Air that holds back 20 miles of rivers and lakes. It's called the Chain of Lakes. And that the water level at that dam is very high right now. And if that dam were to fail, those lakes could drain. And that river feeds into Lake Bel Air, which connects to Clam Lake, Torch Lake, and Elk Lake. And it's the berm on the side of the dam that officials are most worried about.
When we say the water is high, Claire, just how high are we talking?
So I talked to Leslie Meyer, who's the drain commissioner of Antrim County and the operator of dams for the county, and she had this update on that.
It's never been to this height. Last year was the highest recorded heights we had for the river system up here. We are 0.7 feet over last year's high.
So these are record levels that we're seeing.
So, sorry, Claire, just to repeat, the concern on the dam side is that this area may be drained out, but the possibility for water overwhelming banks would be on the Clam Lake, Torch Lake, Elk Lake side of things.
Correct. And there's even a lot of homes that are still along the river before it feeds into any lake that you know, if the dam were to completely fail, those homes along the river could be totally washed out.
Right. I think a lot of, in addition to people who live there year-round, a lot of Michiganders may have visited some of those areas in the summer and know where we're talking about. What is your sense, Claire, of how many people in those regions have chosen to leave at this point?
Yeah, so in Antrim County, where this is taking place, there's a ready order along that part of the intermediate river just after the dam. There's no evacuation yet, no evacuation order yet. The village of Bel Air is not particularly at risk. It's, again, mostly those houses along the river that'd be in danger. And I talked to the sheriff's office who'd been going around to houses nearby, and he said it is a lot of vacation homes in this area. A lot of people are not here yet for the summer. But there's more rain coming and there are year-round residents. I spoke to one man who lives right by the dam and he had his car packed and he had an Airbnb booked ready to go if he needed it.
Wow. Were there any other precautions that you observed people taking to try to get ready for what may come?
Yeah, so I know from another reporter at IPR, Austin Rolater, who lives in Bel Air, that there were volunteer crews there overnight filling and stacking sandbags on top of the dam. And they did successfully fix up one seepage in the berm on the side of the dam. This is the Bel Air resident that I talked to yesterday who was thinking about evacuating. And he and some neighbors were stacking sandbags along the riverbank near his house.
These are a hot commodity right now, these sandbags. Everybody's buying them. So I bought all the ones at the hardware store. There are about 42 of them. And I may need to get more.
And the house across the river from him, that family had evacuated themselves already.
Right. Okay, A.J. Jones, let's turn to you. Can you tell us about what areas you and the other folks at WCMU are keeping an eye on today?
Sure. So we're keeping a very close eye on sort of the northern lower peninsula, the Sheboygan area, for a few reasons. Primarily, the Sheboygan Dam, because of, you know, spring runoff and melting snow from last month's widespread massive snowstorms, as well as unseasonable rain, the water levels at the Sheboygan Dam have risen significantly. Right now, the Sheboygan River, and this is actually an update that came through just before I came on with you guys, the Sheboygan River is 6.6 inches away from the top of the Sheboygan Dam. Sheboygan County has a flood plan. It's called the Ready, Set, Go plan. We reached the ready stage, which is when the levels hit about 12 inches under the top of the dam, and that's sort of telling people in the area, immediate area, to sort of prepare for evacuation. If we hit six, then people should start taking more significant preparations, you know, getting food together, preparing vehicles, and preparing family members and pets. Now, the area that would be most impacted if the dam were to fail is downtown Sheboygan, north of the dam, going out towards Lake Huron. The county sheriff's office put out a flood plan a few days ago that sort of suggested that the areas around the river, close to the river, maybe going out to Main Street in Sheboygan would be the most impacted in a potential flood. The DNR projected that if the dam were to fail, you know, they said it wouldn't be the sort of Edenville 2020 style collapse, which, you know, flooded away an entire communities. What they said is that any flooding from the dam spillage would only get as high as 2 feet. That's what Emma reported last night. But there's still, like I said, are concerns, and you know, people have been notified that they should potentially be preparing to evacuate. Also, last night, there were evacuations after the Little Black River watershed. The levee broke in that area, and that affects sort of the west side of the city near the river. So there have been evacuations. That evacuation is unrelated to the dam. And really, just across of all of northern Michigan, we have had widespread flooding to sort of illustrate it for you. We do, you know, weather reports here at the station at WCMU, and there genuinely are so many like flood warnings that we had to like write a general message saying that the entire area is facing flood warnings. Please check your local emergency management announcements. So I spoke to the Montcalm County Road Commission this morning, and they told me, that's a little south of us here in Mount Pleasant, that, you know, they're going to be dealing with washouts all day. Presque Isle, there's video I saw that Cam Cabot, the state legislator, posted of a road in Presque Isle that was completely ripped apart by you know, by the widespread flooding. And so we've been kind of looking at the whole area as really dealing with a lot of flooding and unfortunate weather.
AJ, one of the things that's been on my mind is that these areas are largely rural. What are the challenges for flood prep for people who you've been talking to?
Yeah, it's been interesting because, you know, there are areas, like I said, the dam in particular affects the downtown area, but Sheboygan in particular, there are a lot of older folks up here who aren't really getting some of the notifications that are coming out because a lot of them are coming out through Facebook. Now, granted, there are emergency alerts that people can sign up for, but a lot of these incremental updates are coming through the internet. And I had a pretty interesting conversation with a lady from Sheboygan. Her name is Sarah Olson, and she told me that, you know, and this was a conversation we had late last week where she told me that she was going around and just telling some of her older neighbors, hey, this is a thing that's happening. Maybe you should start preparing. Sarah herself lives a few blocks away from the concern zone for potential flooding. And she told me that she herself is having her own sort of challenges in preparing.
We have two people in the house with, well, three technically, people in the house with severe chronic illnesses. So we had all the bags packed with medications and documentation and all of our devices and device chargers and that kind of thing.
You know, outside of just sort of the logistics of getting people aware, and, you know, officials have really been working to get the Michigan State Police have been, you know, their emergency management department have been providing these incremental updates pretty consistently morning to morning about the status of the dam. They've been telling people to prepare to go bags and, you know, basically have a plan. But one thing, like I said, sort of going back to my last answer, is there is widespread flooding. There's a lot of water over roads. There are plenty of roads in Sheboygan County specifically that are closed. So it's also a matter of logistically how getting a route out of the city. Now, granted, we have not hit the stage where we are having evacuations related to the dam. So that is what those routes will be something that will be a bit more clear if we are at that point. But, you know, there is also the concern that it's just very hard to get around right now in northern Michigan because a lot of roads are either eroded or there's water over them.
Reporter A.J. Jones of WCMU in Mount Pleasant. A.J., thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've also been speaking with Claire Keenan-Kurgan of Interlochen Public Radio. Claire, thank you so much and stay safe.
Thank you, April.
We need to take a quick break now. When we come back, a Northern Michigan writer talks about social media's theft of our attention and what they did to reclaim their time. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Smartphones and social media apps are pretty much omnipresent in our lives at this point. Our friends, the news outlets, our favorite brands are accessible seemingly at all times through these tiny computers we carry around. And don't get me wrong, the internet can be really fun. But the other side of that sword is that we are subject to constant distraction and the quick dopamine hits of the endless scroll. If you've ever said to yourself, I really got to get off my phone, you'll want to check out the new book by Michigan writer and artist Cody Cook Parrott. Parrott's art practice, which has included quilting and dance over the years, won them a healthy social media following. But ultimately, they came to see the small screen as more damaging than helpful. They've detailed their own digital detox and the systems they built to reclaim their attention in the book, The Practice of Attention. Cody Cook Parrott joins us now. Cody, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me, April. I'm thrilled to be here.
So is there such a thing as an addiction that is so widely shared that it actually becomes the modern condition?
Ooh, chills. that is maybe my favorite question I've ever been asked about addiction in general and social media. I mean, you know, I draw so many parallels between my sobriety from alcohol and the sobriety and recovery I long for with technology and social media. And I'm always trying to figure out what that is. But it's so interesting because alcohol is so normalized in our culture in the same way that social media is. So yeah, I think we've seen that. I mean, and with like lesser, maybe impactful substances like sugar or coffee, I mean, I'm sitting here with my tea, but it certainly has caffeine in it. And, you know, we have these addictions or things we're pulled towards that, yeah, just become so normalized. And
yeah, well, as you're talking through your own process with going small screen sober, you touch on a lot of tools that have been useful to you. The idea of a gift economy, writings about creative practice, and also some of the pieces of addiction recovery and its language. I got a strong sense in the book that you're not preaching 12-step for social media necessarily, but just that some kinds of addiction are easier to live with than others. I mean, I could choose people in situations where I could avoid triggers for heroin addiction, but if my addiction is for food, I'd have a whole different set of problems to navigate. So where does that leave us in your view with our tech addictions?
Yeah, you know, and this is where I'm staying really curious in my process now, because when the book came out, I made a decision to experiment with using social media to talk about the book again. And I felt so filled with the practices I really lay out in the book. Like, my life just feels so big that I was like, okay, I'm gonna like dip in and see how that feels. Because like you said, there are certain things that we can become addicted to where like full abstinence is the sort of way forward. But food is a great example. Money is another example, with like shopping, spending, where, you know, we live in capitalism. We're going to keep using money to exchange goods and services. We need to nourish ourselves. That's an important part of life with food. And so I think the book really speaks to kind of going at it from all different angles and just experimenting with trying, like, okay, do a digital detox. How does it feel to be totally off social media? You know, does that feel better? And for me, having completely deleted all of my accounts, I didn't feel all the way better. In the way that, like, being totally off alcohol, I was like, okay, I feel all the way better. It felt a little more like my experience sometimes with food, caffeine, spending. So yeah.
Maybe the next logical step is to talk a little bit more about the sensations. I mean, we have some information publicly available now about the kind of dopamine hits that the makers of social media, although they're not the only actors in the digital space, about how they're trying to work us. Can you talk more about what you discovered as you sort of opened yourself up to listen and feel the sensations of being disconnected from small screen?
Yeah, I'm so grateful to the documentary The Social Dilemma, which was really where I learned so much more about the way these apps work, and that they are, like you said, you know, these dopamine hits we get when we look at them, they're completely constructed and built to give us these sensations that feel really good and sparkly for like 3 seconds and then crash us out. And then the best way to self-soothe from crashing out is to search for the dopamine hit again. So, you know, that's why these apps keep us on them. But I think part of that is like looking for the soothing of the nervous system in other places. And so that's why I talk so much about movement and spirituality and research and walking and swimming and writing. And, you know, when I really fill my life with those practices, I reach for the phone so much less because I'm more regulated and inspired.
Okay. I have to say, I feel like you did cheat a little bit, because anyone who has a quilting practice already knows something about meditative motion and and stillness. But I don't know. I mean, am I selling this short here? I mean, was it, did that make it any different for you, the fact that you did have some aspects in your life around movement and around your artwork that provided some easier springboards?
Well, one thing I just want to say that I think surprises people sometimes is, yes, quilting is meditative for me, but also I can quilt and like be listening to an audiobook or watching TV and like doing stuff at the same time. So I'm not necessarily in like an enlightened state all the time when I'm quilting. Like, you know, I might be watching like every season of Schitt's Creek over and over and frantically hand quilting or something. I don't know if that's so meditative per se. But yeah, I think, you know, coming from recovery from alcoholism, what was my springboard really was just like having a relationship already with the spirit of the universe, you know, my version of spirituality, which is totally made up, you know, it's not from any religion. It's if anything, it's, you know, a pull from lots of organized religions and meditation practices and pagan rituals. And, you know, I just make it up as I go along. That's part of my creative practice too. And I think that's what I encourage other people to do who don't feel like they have that springboard or that starting place, is just like get creative and make up your own version of God or spirit or, you know, contemplative practice you want to bring in.
Can I just ask, where your fabric art, your textile art and quilting, how that became maybe one of the main channels where you pour ideas into?
Yeah, I learned to quilt in 2013 from the amazing quilter Eliza Fernand, and it was immediately, it felt like dancing, but making an object, and it just totally changed my life. And, you know, I love dance. It's so important to me, but it's so ephemeral. You don't get a finished product at the end to hand to someone else. And so I loved that I got to translate my improvisational work as a movement artist into fabric textiles. And yeah, it's been 13 years of just experimenting with fabric, and it's my favorite place to be.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Cody Cook Parrott. Their new book is called The Practice of Attention, Cultivating Presence in a Distracted World. One aspect of your thinking on this that people might have even seen on social media, I'm sorry to say, was personal practice. You know, if people know the name Cody Cook Parrott, they may know about your work there. Can you maybe tell the story of how that became something you wanted to share with others?
Yeah. You know, when I deleted that Instagram account, I archived and saved all 900 plus videos. So they don't exist anywhere right now, but it is my goal to like upload them all onto a web page or something. But yeah, in 2015, I started filming myself dancing. I have a BFA in dance from the University of Michigan, and I had graduated 5 years prior and found I wasn't tapped into my creative spirit in dancing. And so I started filming myself. I made an Instagram feed for it called Personal Practice. I noticed I was doing it every day, and I thought, I'm going to try to do this every day for a year. And I did. And it really changed my life. It showed me that when you practice something every day, you get a lot better at it, which I thought was pretty cool. Well, that was never my intention to get better at dancing, but I got better at dancing and more devoted to it as an art form. And so, yeah. And then it existed for 10 years, and I didn't do it every day for 10 years, but I kept it as a vehicle for my creation, and I never got addicted to it. I never followed anyone. I never cared about the followers. It never made money. So it was also going back to the gift economy. You know, in the book, I reference Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, The Service Berry. And, you know, the personal practice sort of felt like that plant in a way of like, here, like, I'm just giving you these videos and I don't want anything in return. So I miss that practice a lot and was thinking about it the other day. So we'll see if something else takes its place.
Percolates, yeah. So you do feel like you would be willing to, with intention, dip a foot back in the river?
Yeah, I just for the last week, I did make an account again on Instagram to dip my foot back in the river, and it's
mostly
fine.
It's mostly book stuff now, I should say.
Yeah, it's just basically me posting the book. I wouldn't even say like definitely follow me. Like I don't feel that way about it. I'm just kind of like, I don't know. I guess it's there. It's humbling to go from 80,000 followers to 400. I'll say that. You know, it's definitely an experience. But you know, I think what Instagram does give us, or social media or a YouTube channel or whatever it is a container. And this is something I talk about so much in the book and in my teaching and my classes, is when we have a container to put our art, we will make it more. So personal practice was the container, and I just don't have a dance container right now. So that doesn't mean I need a new Instagram account for dance, but it might mean I need a new container for it.
I mean, I guess that's what the best spaces on the internet have always been about, is like a place to put a thing that is not necessarily internet itself, or is not content with a big C, but some kind of conversation or images or video that we, or music that we care about.
Exactly.
Yeah. There have to be people who are hearing this right now who are like, you've got to be kidding me. First, as an artist, I had to figure out what I had to say in the world. Then I had to figure out how to be a business person in a creative practice. And now you're telling me I have to get off the internet. That's not exactly what they're saying. But part of what you do now is you do coach other small business creatives. What does that look like for you?
You know, so much of my life is dedicated to hosting classes or one-on-one creative advising or hosting small cohorts of other small business owners to imagine and discover ways of running our businesses that are values aligned and don't rely on social media as much. Because what happened is, even if you still use social media, or for me, it was like, I just liked the idea that, you know, my website link could be more easily accessible. Like that was one of the reasons I decided to try having an account again. You know, the algorithm, unless you're going to like commit to making reels and doing the Instagram algorithm stuff, it's just not going to work that well. And so that's why I, you know, my first thing I always tell artists is to have an email newsletter list. You know, that is the most important thing you can have. You own that list. People can opt in, they can opt out, but you always have access to that. Whereas with social media, your account could disappear at any moment. You know, we saw that with, you know, TikTok remained, but there was that time where it seemed like it was going to disappear. And people were really freaked out because they had built whole businesses around it. So, you know, I really encourage artists and small business owners, even if you're using social media, to not rely on it as a huge part of your business plan.
There's one more thing I wanted to ask you about. Some of us turn to online communities because it's addictive. They're addictive. And, you know, there are funny pictures of cats. And the next thing you know, your only happiness in the day is more cats, more cats. And then some of us turn to online communities because we don't have access to community in the places we live in the real world. And I know that you've thought about this. As you know, as someone who's living the life of a queer person in a rural space in the United States of America, it's often seemed to me like there could be a very fine line between maintaining a thriving online life with human connection and retreating online just because your real life feels so alien and so painful and like you're never going to find your place in it. What kinds of things came up as you were writing and wanting to speak to, you know, some of the legit reasons why people live online?
Yeah, thank you so much for these questions and and framing it up this way. I mean, this is a conversation that my girlfriend, Catherine, and I are having all the time in our home as, like you said, as trans people living, you know, in a town of 102 people in Cedar, Michigan. You know, we're definitely asking these questions. And, you know, Katie really was living out west for many years where there was, you know, so much more trans community there. And so she really relies on like Discord groups and, you know, online communities where there's just more of an abundance of trans women than there is necessarily in Northern Michigan. And, but we've also been kind of keeping our eyes open to be like, hold on a second, like Up North Pride is organizing this thing. Like, we should go to that in person, you know, and like just starting to notice, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, there's not enough other queer people here. And it's like when you open your eyes a little bit and look around and pay attention to who's organizing and who's been where you are for longer than you, like there are people there. You can find your people, but it takes a little extra effort. And I think that's maybe what we've lost in some of the technology addiction or comfort of being online, is that willingness to just like step out a little bit more. So to anyone who's feeling that, I would just say like, step out a little bit more, risk being awkward at the event that you don't know anyone at, and just kind of see what happens and what falls into place.
Cody Cook Parrott is the author of The Practice of Attention, Cultivating Presence in a Distracted World. They live in Cedar, Michigan. Cody, thank you so much for talking with us. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, April. I really appreciate it.
That's it for Stateside for today. It's Just Politics is directly ahead with some inside track for you on this year's midterm campaigns, plus races of statewide interest in Michigan. We'll be back with you again tomorrow. Till then, take care.